When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is The Rock Podcast, and I'm Denny Somach. As a rock historian, producer, and best-selling author, I've been conducting hundreds of interviews over the years. On this episode, we have one of the elder statesmen of rock and roll, Roger Earl, a founding member of one of the best live rock bands in history, Foghat. Now, they formed in 1971 when Roger, Dave Peverett, a.k.a. Lonesome Dave on guitar and vocals, Tony Stevens on bass, after all three musicians left the popular British group Savoy Brown. Rod Price joined on guitar and slide guitar, and that's Foghat. Now, you may know them from their debut album, which featured an amazing cover of Willie Dixon's I Just Want to Make Love to You. Later records include Fool for the City, Drivin' Wheel, Stone Blue, and the classic track Slow Ride, which was named one of the top 50 best hard rock songs of all time by many music papers as well as VH1. They have a new album out, Sonic Mojo, and it's some of the best work they've ever done. Roger's been in the business for 52 years, and he talks about it all, including his audition with Jimi Hendrix. This guy has seen everything, including early shows by Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, you name it, he's been there. I hope you enjoy listening to this conversation with Roger Earl.
Hi, Denny.
How are you doing?
Hi, Denny.
Linda, how are you doing?
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
God, I haven't seen you in a lot. I saw this guy. I said, wow, this is so cool. Denny, how you been?
Okay, last time we did it from a studio in Philadelphia, and then we went to lunch.
I know. That was a long time ago.
He hasn't changed at all.
No, neither have we. You know, we don't change anyway. I'm going to leave you to your interview. Have fun. I hope we get to see you soon.
Yes. I'm living in Florida now, so I don't know when you're coming back to Florida.
Where?
I live in Boynton Beach, outside Delray.
I know where that is.
Well, we have a studio down in DeLand.
Oh, okay.
And two of our guys are from Florida. New Smyrna and Melbourne.
Okay.
Playing in Anna Maria Island.
I have a friend who lives in Boynton Beach.
Nancy and Bill live in Boynton Beach.
And John Moraitis.
John Moraitis.
Alias Fat John.
Okay. Florida.
Anyway.
Good seeing you.
Nice to see you, Linda.
Bye, honey.
Bye. So, Roger, you got a new album out. I got to tell you, it's really good. One of the best you've done in years. I heard the first single and I said, wow.
So. Yeah, it's
Sonic Mojo. I know, I forgot to mention.
Yeah, right. And hold on. It gets even better.
Oh, colored vinyl, probably?
Yeah.
Oh wow, purple. Okay, great. Excellent. Why 17? How many 17 years since the studio album?
Well, no, 7 years since the last studio. But this is our 17th studio album.
Okay, I got it.
We've had numerous live albums. Since Dave passed, we've made 4 studio albums and 3 or 4 live albums. So yeah, we keep putting stuff out there. This one took. The last one we did was 7 years ago, I think. It was Under the Influence. And actually, Scott Holt sang on a couple of those tunes and played guitar. Right.
Yeah.
Charlie Hune retired nearly 2 years ago now. That was kind of strange, but I don't think anybody feels good about saying, I'm retiring now. I know I wouldn't like it. I hated it a couple of times when I damaged myself and couldn't play. But Scott Holt is our new lead singer. He's an absolute blast to play with. He played with Buddy Guy for 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I've actually known Scott since 2014. So it's not like he's the new kid. I'm really pleased with the new album.
So this album's on your own label, distributed by Sun. So I dressed appropriately.
Yeah, look, see.
I went and visited that studio several months ago and had to buy the shirt, you know.
Yeah, that's right. I had one. I don't think it's fit me anymore. I bought them years ago. I remember Dave and I went there one time. This was early Foghat days. I don't think we went there when we were in Savoy Brown. Might have done. But I know we went there early days at Foghat, 72, 73. We went to the studio, had a look around. Hallowed ground.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of English bands have recorded there. Yardbirds, bunch. A lot of them I've talked to said they recorded there. So anyway, first single is called Drive On, and you have Kim Simmons on it. How did that come about?
Well, Kim Simmons wrote the songs about when we were doing our last studio album, Under the Influence. I invited Kim to come down and play with us, which he did. And we spent a couple of days finishing up the album down in Nashville, Tennessee, with our producer, Tom Hambridge. Mm-hmm. And after the second day, Kim and I were just hanging out, talking. I think we had lunch together. And he said, I'd really like to write some songs for Foghat. I said, that would be great, but you just have to play on them. He said, okay. Well, that didn't work out. Kim actually sent me the four songs about 3 years ago.
Right.
Just guitar, his vocals, and I think he was playing to a click track. And then he got ill. He couldn't play on the record, and he sent us four tracks. We did three of them. The fourth one we're keeping back for the next record. It was a sad day when we lost Kim, because after we left the band in 71, left Savoy Brown, and I reconnected with Kim in sometime around 76. Savoy Brown played out here on Long Island at the university here, and we've stayed in touch ever since. And the last 10 years or so, we've done a number of shows together, because Savoy Brown was with the same agency. Linda got Savoy Brown with our agency, Paradise Artist. And so we got to play a lot together. And but the three songs that Kim wrote for us, of course, we got our grubby little fingers on it and changed it a little bit. But I was really pleased with the way they turned out. Kim was, his last 20 years or so, every year he would put out an album.
Right.
I mean, all original songs. And I listened to some of them. And I even said to the guys one time, I said, we should probably do some of these songs. But Kim wrote us four songs for us. And I'm grateful. It's a shame he couldn't play on them. But I think he'll be pleased with what we did with them.
Now, for those that don't know, and you can correct me, Savoy Brown has had like 61 members over the years. Is he a real taskmaster?
No, I think it's really hard trying to keep a band together financially. You know, like, everybody has to earn, a living. Everybody has bills to pay. Some of us have families to feed. That the hard part is keeping a band together. I know I've been involved in that, and I think that's what the issue with Kim was, because if you're not working, like Kim decides to take 6 months off to write or record, what do the other three or four band members do? They're not there anymore. It was different when myself and Lonesome Dave were in the band. We played every week. Except when we were in the studio, and it really took more than a week in the studio back then. So we were working all the time. We'd work 7 days a week.
I know. For those that don't know, Could you tell me a little bit about Savoy Brown? Because they were really popular in the States, I think more so than in the UK. And you were doing the college circuit. You were playing everywhere. And you had a huge following over here, but way different from the UK. So what was that like being in that band?
It was great. I joined Savoy Brown in 1967. It was, 19 or 20?
Right.
It was great. I did two auditions. The first audition, I didn't get it. They got another drummer, which lasted about a month. Apparently, he couldn't play a shuffle. Can't join a blues band if you can't play a shuffle. Anyway, he went for the second audition at the Nag's Head in Battersea in England. Borrowed my dad's cars during the week. Put the drums up there, played for about 2.5 hours or more. Then I started backing up the drums, and they said, "Well, where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going back to work." I was a commercial artist. They said, "We got a gig in Birmingham tonight." So that's how that started. But I did
They still talk about you in Detroit.
Detroit. Yeah. What a. I should have worn my Detroit. I've got a shirt. Actually, Charlie Hume gave it to me with Detroit written. I wear it with pride.
Right.
Detroit is a rock and roll city. I have very, very fond memories of playing there, the Grandy Ballroom. And I still have a number of friends there. I did an album a while ago with some friends there, session work and stuff. Detroit is it's a great city, great city. It'll be back.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the new album and some of the songs on it. They're mostly original, but you got, I think, 4 or 5 covers, and I want to ask you about them. The Willie Dixon tune, Let Me Love You, Baby, was that just always a favorite, or?
Well, it was originally Willie Dixon, yeah, but Buddy Guy, I think, did the quintessential version of that. And, of course, Scott Holt played with Buddy Guy for about 10 years. He was the other guitar player in the band, so you know Scott can play. And we had a side project a few years ago with let me explain that. We were doing the Under the Influence album with Foghat, and we were about 3 or 4 songs short for an album, a double album.
Right.
So I invited Scott Holt to come down to our studio and write 3 or 4 songs with us. Instead of writing 3 or 4, we wrote 17. And then that started a side project called Earl and the Agitators, which is basically Foghat now, Brian Bassett, Rodney O'Quinn played on a couple of tracks, but most of them Craig McGregor played on. But Rodney played on the live shows,
right?
And Brian Bassett. So that started our relationship with Scott Holt, Earl and the Agitators. And writing with Scott, especially Scott, I have a ball writing with him. Somebody will have a riff, Brian will have a riff, or Scott will. I'll have some ideas for the lyrics, and it's fun. We have a really good time. We have our own studio, so we have a really great time playing.
So Willie Dixon wrote I Just Want to Make Love to You, which was, of course, one of your earliest songs and probably the first radio hit that you had in America. Did you ever meet him?
Yes.
What was that like?
It was great.
He's a legend. He's written so many songs.
77. Foghat was playing 3 nights at the in Chicago at the amphitheater there. And the first night, Willie Dixon sent his daughter down. We treated her like the princess that she was. Second night, Butch, one of his sons, came down with his sister. And we treated them like the prince and princess we viewed them to be. And they were fabulous kids. And on the third night, the man himself came down. And this is how I read it. I Just Want to Make Love to You was a big hit off the Foghat's first album, single. And we just released the live album. And I Just Want to Make Love to You was the single off of it. So Willie Dixon's getting all this money from this band called Foghat. And I think he sent his kids down there to say, yeah, see what these kids have got under their fingernails, you know? And I guess he got a good report from his kids, because on the third night, the man himself came down, and it was, I have a picture here. We have numerous pictures down at our studio down in Florida of us hanging with Willie Dixon. There would be no rock and roll if it wasn't for people like Willie Dixon and Chuck Berry.
Right. So, and that was, what made you want to cover that? Because that was your first big, big song in America. Was everybody a fan of his? And
yeah. Excuse me. When we were, hold on a second.
No problem.
I can't speak. Hold on. Oh, here we go.
Okay.
Just had some chips. When we were in Savoy Brown, Dave and I would often jam that riff at sound checks. So that's where that came from. Up to that point, I think the Stones did a version of I Just Want to Make Love to You real fast, like a Bo Diddley feel. But I think our version, other than Muddy Waters, of course, which is the version, I think it was real popular. A number of other artists have played our version of I Just Want to Make Love to You, which I think is really cool. You know, it's like, you know, when you've got other blues singers playing your version, like we were just a bunch of kids from London. I think we got it right with that song. And it was very good for us.
Yes, it was. Now, you also covered Howlin' Wolf's How Many More Years, which, of course, Led Zeppelin covered. They called it How Many More Times and said that they wrote it. But you did the original version by Howlin' Wolf. So I imagine you were a fan of his, too.
Yeah. Howlin' Wolf. I mean, what an artist, what a singer, what a harp player. I mean, he was, I remember when I was 15 or 16, I got my first album of Howlin' Wolf. I got it sent over from, I belonged to a record club in Chicago, and they sent it over to this store in London. And I remember when I got it, it was absolutely brilliant stuff. I never got to meet him or see him live, but I've seen him like on various shows. I saw him when he came to England. He toured back when I was 16 or 17 years old, I think. He did
that package tour that, you know, everybody I talk to, every English musician must have been at that show, because they all talk about it.
Oh, yeah. It was like magic. And I remember, and I've seen film footage of like when Muddy gets off the plane and basically the red carpet is rolled out for them. And I think they weren't, you know, but back in the States where they all came from, they weren't treated with the respect and accord that was due them as far as the English musicians and English public as well. You know, the fans, there was some real magic in that early, like Chicago style blues stuff, especially for me anyway, the way it sounded. Muddy's band was just like this fantastic band, and Howlin' Wolf, I mean, his songs were like, they had such power and magic in them. And like from this kid growing up in Southwest London and Central London, it was like, this was like, it was magic. And, you know, tried to play those songs. Obviously we adulterated them somewhat, I think. But I think that was how we learned to play. And like, you know, my passion for that kind of music is still with me. Lonesome Dave said to me one time, I think we were doing an interview somewhere and somebody asked him why he was such a blues fan. It is because, and he said, there's an honesty in the music. There's always a story or something. I'm a big Johnny Cash fan. And like, And when I was like 12, 13 years old, I would sing Johnny Cash songs. Ooh, she loves you, Big River, more than me. But I was the only kid in Southwest London who was singing it. And because my brother, Colin, older brother Colin, would, Johnny was obviously on the Sun label. And again, it was always about the songs. Johnny Cash didn't even have a drummer in his band back then. Luther Perkins on guitar and a bass player, I think. And Johnny, of course, played guitar. But there was always a rhythm and there was always a song there. This is the land of music, America, USA. This is where it all comes from. That wonderful mixture of blues, jazz, rock and roll, bebop, country, hillbilly, gospel music. Mm-hmm. And to this day, this is the land of music. We send music out to the world. And that's, I think that's one of USA's greatest attributes, the fact that we have this music, that all these different things come together and they have this wonderful sounds coming out. It's a shame we can't get everything else as good as our music, but America gave music to the world. It's a good start. Without music, life would be a mistake.
Absolutely. So you're sort of an elder statesman and band leader. You've played with everybody. In fact, I don't know if you're aware of this, but Foghat or yourself, the Zombies and the Who are the only bands that played back then that are playing now whose lead singer is not Mick Jagger.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, for me, it's always been about the music.
Yeah.
I haven't really listened to the Stones' new stuff. I heard something the other day. I guess I'm going to have to get the record. I'm a Stones fan.
It's great. Best thing they've done in a long time. It's a great song.
I mean, I used to go and see them when I was growing up in London, Il Pie Island, the Richmond Club, Ricky Chick, the Marquee. I saw them once. Il Pie Island was my favorite place to see them. It just sounded great in there. But no, I've always been a Stones fan. Charlie Watts, what a great, great drummer. I mean, I remember like a couple of times I saw them back in the day, and actually it was their records that I really liked. The way he played, you know, he was something else. But there again, he did have Keith to play with. I mean, rhythm guitars, I mean, honky tonk women. I mean, the list just goes on forever and ever. The Stones, Rolling Stones. Ladies and gentlemen, the Rolling Stones, the Rolling Stones.
So you pretty much have seen everybody when they started out. So I just want to ask you to give me a few comments about some of the bands that impressed you, because you saw them all in the early days, like Zeppelin, Deep Purple, Jethro Tull. I mean,
yeah.
What were some of the great shows that you remember from the late 60s and early 70s?
Actually, Jethro Tull were great. They had a fantastic drummer. He was a real highlight. We did...
Clive Bunker, right?
Clive Bunker, yeah. Super guy, too. Terrific drummer. But I remember doing a show with... It was with Jethro Tull, Led Zeppelin, and Savoy Brown. And there was another band. It's A Beautiful Day. Harp violin player, I think.
Yeah.
And I believe we were in... Philadelphia, and we were doing a sound check. Bonzo was there, Clive Bunker, myself. I can't remember if it was Jimmy Page and or Kim. I know there was a violin player, probably couldn't hear him very well.
That was a guy from It's a Beautiful Day.
Yeah, right, that's right. But what I remember then, we were just jamming. So we got these three drummers on stage. All you could hear was Bonzo. And we weren't amplified at the time. We were just playing. And he was a hellacious drummer. I got to meet him a number of times. And any time I met him, we had a really good time. I remember one time we were in New York City, down in the village. We were at a bar. And he had a couple of empty Heineken bottles. He was doing drum solos on the table. Didn't break them. table looked a bit damaged afterwards, but he was a fantastic drummer. And I didn't see Zeppelin a lot, but the drummer was the one who impressed me in that band, because he made that band into something else. Like Ginger Baker as a drummer transformed the way drummers approach rock and roll. Those two specifically, and that's a hard thing to do, like to change a whole genre, a whole world of drumming. And throughout history of rock and roll and music, I think there have been drummers that have moved you, but those two in recent times, they put a whole new stamp on it. I mean, Ginger Baker playing, I'd met him a number of times. Also, when I was growing up in London, when I was 17 or 18, I did some shows with him with the band I was in. He was very cordial back then. He was always fine with me, but I read some stories about him. Drummers, they're scary.
What? You should watch the movie, Beware of Mr. Baker.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So I want to talk to you about a few songs that, of course, are sort of like your greatest hits. And I just want you to give me a couple comments about them. Did you know they were going to be big when you first did them? Or, you know, did they get written somewhere unusual? So let me start with Stone Blue.
I thought it was one of my favorite songs ever. The way we played it, I remember at the time our manager said, it's too fast. And I'm like, it's rock and roll. If it was slow, it would be a slow rocker. But Stone Blue, that's a rock and roll song. Yeah. We did that out here on Long Island at the Woolworth Mansion. We had the RCA mobile unit is what we recorded it with. Yeah, it's one of my favorite songs. Rodney, our bass player, sings that one. Yeah, it's a good song. Good record, actually.
Fool for the City.
One of my all-time favorites. Nick Jameson had just joined the band on bass and was also producing that record. We actually took 3 months or so off the road to record. We hadn't really done that since our first album that we did with Dave Edmonds in Wales. So we're up in Sharon, Vermont, on the top of a mountain recording it. And we had a band house down in the valley, and we go up the mountain and each day. It was a lot of fun making that record. But we were working on the arrangement to the song in the studio. We'd put down some basic tracks just to see where we were going with it and getting the arrangement right. And we're back at the house after finishing about 3 or 4 in the morning. Dave and I are sharing a bottle of red wine. And I said, Dave knew where I was going with this. I said, hey, Dave, how many chords are in Fool for the City? And he had a wry smile on his face. And he said, it's only 3, Rog. There's some passing chords, but they don't matter. Anything other than 3 chords has to be viewed with a certain amount of suspicion.
Okay. Tell me about Driving Wheel.
That was Rod's masterpiece. That was from Night Shift album we did over in Connecticut. That was interesting because it was a time when Rod and Dave were struggling to put songs together. And I think it was also Craig McGregor on bass's first album with us. And we set up in, myself and Craig McGregor were in one room together with a nice big drum room, great sounding drums over there. And we were working on the arrangement of the song and all the breaks and stuff, but we were playing to a click track. Now, which, you can do. It's not my favorite way of making music, but that's a tool that you use, if especially when you're either creating a song or if you don't know the song and like you're reading a chart, which I don't do. But we played to a click track to keep everything even. And Dave was sitting there with an electric guitar, and he'd be in the drum room and bass room, and he'd say, guitar solo. Now, chorus, verse, break coming up. And Craig McGregor and myself would have to know when to sort of like move the song and play different parts and get all the stops and breaks. There's a number of them in that song. It was, you know, it's like, I think with anything, there's lots of different ways that you have to learn, for want for a better word, your craft. You know, when you're playing drums, you know, I prefer like just jamming and playing and let it happen organically and have fun with it. But sometimes you just have to work. We worked on that song, and because Rod's guitar playing was so intense, especially that song, Driving Wheel was like a masterpiece as far as I'm concerned. Rod Price is one of his greatest efforts. And then we actually laid down the track first and the arrangement, and then Rod overdubbed his guitar because then he could just wail away. And one of the issues I think we probably had with it is that Rod needed to like have a vehicle, a road to travel on to put his get his guitar right. And I think it's one of Rod's greatest efforts as far as like recording.
Okay, so got to ask you obviously about Slow Ride, which is one of those songs when it comes on the radio, you got to turn it up. It's like your free bird. You know, did you realize it was going to be as big? And I mean, it's still played today.
Yeah, I don't know. Actually, at the time when we recorded, Nick Jameson again was our producer and played bass on it. He was the one who really helped arrange it. When we first started recording it, rehearsing it, I should say, Nick had just joined the band, and we were rehearsing in myself and Rod Price had a house out here on Long Island, and I was living actually upstate New York with my girlfriend, but in Bearsville. And Nick and I came down. Nick had just joined the band, and we just started jamming. It's like a John Lee Hooker riff played at 4/4 as opposed to a shuffle. You know, that's where it came from. And Nick Jameson said, "Hey, Rod, just go bang." 2 floor tom-toms and a bass drum. On 2 and 4. So that's where it started. Nick Jameson did all the arrangement on the song. Dave said, "Oh, I've got some words that are fit to that." And that's how it happened. Nick and I mixed that song as the single, and the B-side was Save Your Lovin'. We were mixing it up in Sharon, Vermont, and then we drove back down to Bearsville and went to see Paul Fishkin, who was in charge of Bearsville Records, and we played it for him. And it was 7 minutes and 40 seconds, or maybe it was 8 minutes, I think. And Paul Fishkin said, "No, it's too long for a single." But that was the only single that the band actually said, "This is the single." We fought tooth and nail for it. Eventually, they cut it down to about 4 minutes, I think, anyway. But a number of FM radio stations, FM, actually played the full-length version. But that was the only single where the band actually said, "This is the single." Myself and Nick Jameson were very adamant about that. That's so the only one.
Are you going to reissue your Christmas song?
Which one?
All I Want for Christmas. I didn't realize you had more than one.
Yeah, we got a number of them. In fact, I talked to Linda, our manager, about putting out a Christmas record. We've got like 4 or 5, maybe 6 songs, actually, Christmas songs. So maybe we can do that. I don't know. We're kind of busy at the moment, like promoting Sonic Mojo.
Right, your newest album.
Yeah.
Okay, so I got to ask you just a couple more questions.
Yeah.
Why didn't the Rick Rubin project work?
I didn't know much about that. I've been trying for years to talk Dave into getting the original band back together. It was two foghats traveling around America. David left the band in 1984 and moved back to England. I carried on playing with Craig McGregor and Eric Cartwright. Anyway, Rick Rubin wanted to do a record with the original band Foghat. that's as I understood it from our manager at the time. Rick Rubin was busy either with Mick Jagger and or Johnny Cash. If you were with Mick Jagger or Johnny Cash, I mean, I don't mind being third in line for that. But it didn't happen. I think basically we all wanted to get in the studio and work again, like put a record together with the original band. Tony Stevens was back in the band. Nick Jameson was producing it, which I was fine with. Nick Jameson is an absolute brilliant musician and an incredible producer as well. And he's one of those people that can play everything really, really well. Don't you hate people like that?
He's from Philadelphia, so I know him. He was in a band called The American Dream.
That's right.
And I think he did some acting and, you know, but he's done a lot of stuff, produced a lot of stuff.
He's living in Reykjavik, Iceland now. We keep in touch with him. We're good friends. He does voiceovers, acting, comedy. He has a blues band now. In fact, we're doing, I guess we could, we're doing with Folkout, I guess it's like a documentary.
Yes.
And so I will get Nick over here. We've been doing it for the last 5 years or so, working on it. Maybe it will be finished when I'm finished.
Okay. What was your audition for Hendrix like?
I came in fifth or sixth. That was it was fantastic in in retrospect, the fact that I got to play with him, and he was very generous with his time. His manager Chaz Chandler, I'd played in a band that Chaz put together when I was about 18, so he had my phone number. It didn't go anywhere, but he called me up. I was working as a commercial artist and asked me if I'd heard about him, you know, all the famous, you know, Pete Townsend, Jeff Beck, you know, everybody was talking about this magician of a guitar player that was here. I did the audition. I borrowed my dad's car. My brother and a friend of his helped me set my drums up. There was a bunch of drummers down there. There was three or four drummers before me. When we were outside in the rain, we were waiting for the club to open. It's midday in just off Piccadilly Circus. And Jimmy came up to me and started talking to me about songs he'd written the night before. He played, he had a Marshall stack and it was just me playing. And I have to be honest, I didn't really have a clue. playing and I couldn't find where two and four was and I was fumbling, and then he did a slow blues and I went and that was good. Then he did like a Chuck Berry song. He did a Bob Dylan song, I think, but he was very generous. I was there for probably half an hour, maybe 40 minutes playing. It seemed like that, but he did the right thing. Mitch Mitchell was an incredible drummer and really brought some real magic to Jimi Hendrix's experience. I remember listening to the first album. I shared a flat in London with my best friend, Dave Hutchins, a bass player. I remember listening to Jimi Hendrix's first album. We were sitting there going, you know, a gape. It was like, yeah, it was incredible. It was music that none of us had ever heard it was magic. Jimmy was magic.
So how's the wine business and how did you get into that?
I kind of like wine. It's really good for you. Somebody shouldn't have told me that. The wine business is doing okay. We haven't made anything in a couple of years. We have a 2014 Chardonnay, and we have a 2013 Pinot Noir, both from the West Coast, mid coast of California. We're out working with some winemakers in Oregon. We were out there this summer and I met a couple of winemakers out there, and we talked, and actually gave us one of them gave us a case of all their vintages of 21 and 22 vintages, four different, three whites and a Pinot Noir. And of course, the band sort of locked onto them. I managed to save four bottles and brought them home so I could taste them here. But we're probably going to be working with them and get some wines, probably 2022 vintage. The other wines are going good. It's like back in the day, I think Paola was probably cocaine or something else. Now we send bottles of wine to people. A bit more civilized.
Okay. What's next? You're on tour. Is this just a few dates you're doing? Are you going to do a full tour? What's the story?
We do between 60 and 70 dates a year. It's slowing down a bit now. Like maybe once or twice a week. We're gonna roll to our old and rock till we drop. Most of our dates we fly in. I bring my pedals and cymbals and snare drum, and the backline is supplied a DW drum kit to my specs and Marshall amps for everybody else. So it works. We don't have to go in a bus. That can get old after a while. You know, like going on the road for like 2 or 3 months. I like coming home and playing twice a week, is maybe three times a week is great. Then you get to go home 2 or 3 days. It's quite civilized. You get to go fishing, hang out with the wife and the girlfriend. They're one of the same.
Yes. All right. So your new album is called Sonic Mojo. It's on your own label, distributed by Sun. You want to hold it up again? You can. And it comes in vinyl as well as CD. And the vinyl is colored vinyl. Right. And anyway, I want to thank you for taking time out and wish you a lot of luck with this new album.
Thank you. Oh, no, I have to read something for you.
Sure.
Sonic, adjective, a frequency within the audibility range of the human ear of waves and vibrations. Mojo, noun, a charm or amulet thought to have magic powers. Music with magic powers. There you go.
That's what most of the old blues singers say, right? I got my mojo.
Mojo. I've been happy with just about every record we put out, but I'm particularly proud of what we're doing now. The band, we have the time of our lives on stage. I'm really blessed by having musicians in the band that are not only brilliant musicians, but some of the best people I know. Nobody argues. Everybody loves to play. We're up to an hour and 45 minute shows now, because most of the time it's an hour and 15 minutes. And we say, can we play a bit longer? And they get some places, yes, some places, no. But I'm having the time of my life playing with these people. It's a real band in every sense of the word. And I'm real fortunate.
Well, again, I want to thank you very much for giving us your time, giving a little history. I love talking to you. You are the history of British rock, and I'll see you on the road, and look forward to hearing this album all over the place.
Thank you, Denny. I'm going to roll till I'm old and going to rock till I drop.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger. Appreciate it. Say goodbye to Linda for me.
I will do. You got it. Bye, Linda, says Danny.
Bye, Danny.
I'll see her. Tell her I'll see her on the road.
See you on the road.
I'll see you on the road.
Okay.
All right, stay healthy, have fun. Maybe we'll see you in Florida.
You too. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
That's Roger Earl discussing some highlights of his career and the new Foghat album, Sonic Mojo. Thanks for listening to The Rock Podcast. We're available on all the usual platforms, wherever you get your podcasts, and we have a video version on YouTube as well. You can also sign up for our channel
and you'll be notified when a new episode is released. It's free, no charge. The Rock Podcast is now the number one podcast for classic rock, so thank you for listening. Find us at the website, therockpodcast.com, and we also have a Facebook page. You can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to me at hello@therockpodcast.com. That's hello@therockpodcast.com. Thanks to one of our sponsors, AuthenticRockCollectibles.com, where you can see a lot of classic items. Check it out. I'm Denny Somach, and that's it for this episode.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.